This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, a new chapter in New Hampshire's immigration story opens with the Bedford Church helping Sudanese refugees to get online. Also today, challenges for families of mentally ill teens. And Internet Sherpa Brady Carlson brings in his latest quarry of viral news and videos, from those intended by presidential candidates to those they wish would just go away. But we begin with what happens when the desire to have smart, healthy, good-looking children meets today's share-everything culture. This story starts with an elite donor to a high-end sperm bank, which helps about 10,000 women a year conceive. The donor received high ratings on bulletin boards and blogs shared by users. We'll let Robin Rahm pick it up from there. She wrote about the prolific donor's discovery of untold progeny for The Atlantic in an article we might add wryly called All His Children. Robin, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Hi, nice to be here.
So tell us about this Uber donor who you call Raul Williams in the article, not his real name.
Right, yes. Well, Raul is a very bright, tall, attractive attorney, and he, before he went to law school, decided to donate sperm to make a little bit of extra money. His wife was pregnant and he was working on a novel, so he needed some cash quickly, and he had a lot of education, went on to Craigslist, as many of us will, and the easiest job to get with a lot of education and no skills, as he put it, was to become a sperm donor.
How much money did he make doing this?
He made about $10,000.
And this was with a pretty Tony, I guess, California-based cryobank, correct? He was just the kind of person they were looking for, I guess.
Exactly, yes. The bank needs donors that have profiles like his, because once you are shopping for genetic material, you're going to be, you know, as any consumer would be, picky about what you buy.
Did he ever give much consideration to where his genetic material would end up?
I don't think he thought it through in the way that he's being forced to think it through now, certainly. I think that it, you know, it seemed like a generous, altruistic thing to do for some cash. And then, you know, it turns out to be a lot of children later on down the line, but it seemed abstract, I think, at the time, and then became much more, obviously, concrete.
Well, let's talk about how it got concrete. He did discover, with a simple Google search, what, Robin? Can you unroll the story for us here?
Sure. He was talking to some colleagues in a carpool, and they had heard a story. They were telling tales in the carpool, and he said that he had been a sperm donor before law school, and a colleague asked if he had ever Googled his donor number. And Raul had not done that, and he went to work, and he did. And what he found, the first hit when he typed in his donor number, was a blog called Django Journals. And this blog was about one of his offsprings, Django.
Mm-hmm.
But what was interesting about the blog, or alarming, depending on your perspective, was that when he clicked on it, there were a bunch of photographs that appeared. And the first photograph really caught his eye. He recognized it, and he couldn't quite figure out why. And it turned out he recognized it because it was a photo of himself. He had sold a baby picture of himself to the bank for $200.
Oh, my goodness.
And so it was his picture followed by pictures of babies. The first picture was Django, very strong resemblance between his baby picture and Django. And then because this mother had put the donor number up on her blog, other mothers of children of Raul's had written in and sent baby pictures of their children. So, you know, just one morning he clicked on this blog and got to see several of his genetic offspring. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the first moment that he saw, I guess I called it the concrete, you know, outcome of this altruistic and cash-making adventure and sperm donating.
We find that the mothers, as you write, rate the quality of donations, and they can actually locate each other and compare notes. That's what's going on, huh?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we can rate pretty much everything online, so it just, you know, it makes sense that if you're shopping for something as important as sperm, you know, that's going to make a child, that you'll do everything you can to make sure that other people have had a good experience.
Robin Rahm is with us. She's a journalist with The Atlantic, and she's talking about a story of a man who did not foresee the consequences of his donations to a very tony sperm bank in California. Well, that's the thing, Robin. Your article brings up a few things. You know, the notion of sperm as product to be rated for quality. And I guess what struck me is the kind of matter-of-fact way those ratings were doled out by the users.
Absolutely, yeah. People wrote in that their children were bright and healthy and, you know, only a shellfish allergy, you know, nothing else. And who knows, these are all very young children. But it is interesting to read those reviews and to read the responses to the reviews, very enthusiastic shoppers. And they read like reviews of any product online.
And they're considered siblings by at least one mother who's been tracing relations to her child. And I'm thinking, you know, as the kids grow up, will they also be able to find each other? Will they call each other siblings? What are the future implications here?
I believe that the term is diblings, so donor siblings. And yes, they're all, you know, related by their biological father. And because if they grow up knowing their donor number, it should be relatively easy for them to connect. Because, you know, a lot of these mothers are connected online, and I would imagine that there are already sibling registries online for mothers who are interested in knowing the siblings of their offspring. And these kids of Raoul's are all under five, so it's difficult to know what will happen. You know, it'll take another 8 to 10 years to really know how these siblings will connect, but it seems obvious that they will be able to connect online given the connectedness of their mothers.
What does this reflect to you? You know, as you're looking at the whole picture, I mean, our concern for looks and health and brightness maybe sort of blinds us from the outcome? I'm not sure.
Well, I think that women who would like to have a child and need to use a sperm bank all have to face the fact that, you know, the banks aim to make 25 to 30 families with each donor. So while that's not how the bank, you know, the bank doesn't sit down with you and go over that the first thing, you know, they talk about the health of the children and the success of the bank. I think that it is in, you know, it is in the literature and it is in the information that the bank gives to mothers, but I think it's easy to skip over that when you really, really want a healthy child, and that's how you plan to go about it.
Well, Robin, thanks for joining us, and thanks for telling us the story today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Robin Rahm is the author of the memoir, The Mercy Papers. She read about a prolific donor who meets his progeny online for The Atlantic's December issue. You will find a link to read the story at wordofmouthradio.org. And coming up, Facebook retrenches again and other online oddities when Awesomator Brady Carlson rocks the mic after a short break from NHPR. And my friends are going to try to move your feet. You see, welcome back to Word of Mouth. Well, that music, such as it is, means Word of Mouth's internet Sherpa Brady Carlson is back with us. After his weekday shifts hosting All Things Considered, Brady likes to unwind by gathering new items for Here's What's Awesome. That's our frequent look at the web and its endless list of memes, trends, and viral hits. Brady, great to have you back.
I was going to think of a clever response to that, but it's...
You can't even...
I can't remember it, sorry.
I think it's the Department of Energy is what you're looking for. Everyone's seen the viral video of the moment by now. This is Texas Governor Rick Perry's oops moment, if we need to remind you.
And I will tell you, it's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
We need five.
Oh, five,
yeah,
okay. So
five.
Commerce, education, and
I'm starting to feel sorry for the old chap. Another video has popped up of GOP frontrunner candidate Herman Cain having trouble answering a question about Libya. This was before an editorial board from a newspaper. These are the kinds of things a candidate, of course, will hope just never see the light of day. So what are they hoping that voters will look at?
Well, they have been producing a lot of videos, and some of them are more straightforward campaign ads, which more and more are simply being posted to the web and not being run as paid ads. They figure the media is going to cover them anyway. Why pay to, you know, you can get the same amount of exposure just relying on the media to cover it. Many of these videos are not 30-second ads, though. They're actually produced more like movie trailers. The site Tech President did something kind of funny. They took a series of these candidate ads and compared them to the trailer for the movie Transformers 3 and found they were actually more similar than you might expect.
Well, let's hear from one. This is by former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, who is gaining in the polls.
The American people create jobs, not government.
Would you reappoint Ben Bernanke?
I would fire him tomorrow. I think the Fed should be audited.
I'm not particularly worried about Governor Perry and Governor Romney frightening the American people when President Obama scares them every single day.
When I was Speaker, we added 11 million jobs in a bipartisan effort, including welfare reform.
So, cue the dramatic music,
yeah,
a very cinematic approach. We've seen this kind of thing before, but it's certainly a world apart from viral video.
Yeah, it's not exactly the kind of thing. You know, it's not like 4 years ago when Mike Huckabee was making a video for the internet crowd with Chuck Norris trying to get some buzz there. This has been a little more conventional. That's not to say that the candidates haven't been doing the typical web things, Twitter feeds, blogs, you know, behind the scenes videos. But it's not necessarily innovative stuff. By now, that stuff is conventional. It's been done for a couple of campaign cycles now. One thing that did catch my eye recently, there is a page on Herman Cain's website. It's actually the page most people won't ever see. It's the 404 page, the page you go when you click
when
on
you
the
get
link.
An error.
Yeah, when you go to the wrong thing. And it says, like an Obama policy, this 404 page will get you nowhere. Whether you agree with the sentiment or not, it is a very webby, non-traditional campaign joke in a sea of mostly traditional campaign content.
Well, no matter what they do, they can't manage all of it, obviously. There's been a series of lip-syncing videos where candidates, you know, we see them making speeches, shaking hands, kissing babies, but their voices are actually filled in with just gibberish to match the lips, saying some pretty funny stuff. Here's the one of Herman Cain.
I can probably freak on you. It's just crazy. No, we ain't never have this. An old rotten eagle's nest. Nachos and hogwash. This is my juice, and I'm hungry.
It's just silly.
The bad lip sync folks they started out by working on bands. They would take music videos and rewrite the songs to fit what the lips were saying. And they very wisely moved on to politics.
And they're equal opportunity lip syncers, you know, Michelle Bachmann, Romney as well. All right. So that's all regular web fare here in American politics, but maybe not in Russia. Now, tell us about Vladimir Putin's saucy new ad campaign.
Yeah, this is an ad you will not see from any of the candidates in the 2012 race in America. There's a couple of 20-somethings walk into the polling place. There's this sort of light techno music playing in the background, and they're flirting, and then all of a sudden they walk into the polling booth together. You don't actually see anything risque happening, but the message is very clear. You know, it's a vote for Putin means love.
Well, or something
or
like it.
Or something like that, yeah.
Well, Putin's been on this sort of YouTube branding campaign over the last few years. I mean, that video where he kind of saves the TV crew by shooting a tiger. Or him doing judo. I mean, is this what the Russian people are looking for in a leader?
I from what I know of Russian political culture, you can sort of build this larger-than-life brand of yourself. And Putin is sort of a small, balding guy with a, you know, kind of a high voice. It's probably a wise imaging move for him to show himself, you know, with a judo outfit on or shooting large game, things like that. You know, either that or he thinks he looks great without a shirt on, and one or the other.
Well, and for those who want to save rather than shoot animals, there's just an amazing video on the Atlantic website of a team airlifting black rhino to a reserve. Now, they're doing this by helicopter. Just imagine the scene, these massive animals bound by their feet flying over the Serengeti to new areas where they will have larger areas to roam. Let's hear it.
This is the kindest way we've yet discovered of moving a rhino from the field to a vehicle.
It is a big operation. It's a lot of animals to try and move in a really short time.
There are no roads. There is no access whatsoever. You know, most of these parks are wilderness area.
Now, of course, we do have links to for everyone to see these videos for themselves. But what's going on here, Brady?
This is another example of how wildlife groups have really used the visual side of the web effectively. They put together a lot of videos, photo slideshows, things like that, to raise awareness of conservation and animal issues. This is really high quality stuff. This is a nice video. You're not going to confuse it with like the movie Operation Dumbo Drop, where there's an elephant flying around for kids. Two other sites I wanted to mention on the same vein: Yuzu UK, which is all over YouTube. It has really cute short animal stories from zoos around the world. And zooborns.com, which is baby animals born at zoos. You don't get cuter than that.
Okay, Brady, last time you were here, you talked about a change to Facebook where the site would select top stories for each user and then have this fuller news feed in the right-hand corner, so like a ticker. How's it working out for them?
Well, they're walking it back already, not that well. A lot of the people who didn't like it said it was just hard to kind of figure out why they were choosing certain things as top stories. A friend of mine had a kid recently, and that got bumped down to the bottom of the page because I needed to hear the top story, which was someone else had eaten a sandwich. So you can now choose whether you want to keep that model of letting Facebook choose the top stories or whether you can just have the most recent things at the top of your page. Most people can now do that. Everybody's going to have access to it very soon.
Okay, Brady. Awesomeator Brady Carlson is here with us for the What's Viral in News and Culture on the Web. And again, you can find links to everything that we're talking about. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also submit your own awesome finds on our Facebook page. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. All right. You've been following the Occupy Wall Street movement and its satellite protests for the past, 2 months, I guess, they've been active. Police have cleared out some of these encampments, like the one in Oakland, I think Portland, Oregon as well. Is this the time? Is it make or break time for Occupy?
I think it's hard to say. And actually, I've been hearing some of the places where people have been cleared out, they're already regathering. So it may that they just keep going on. If there is any change at all, I think it'll start to evolve. Anything that's web-based or viral like these protests are, they start to find new techniques, new things to do. We've heard a couple of them. One is called the mic check. It's a group of protesters who show up at a political event or a speech, and at a predetermined time, they interrupt the speaker. This happened to Michelle Bachmann, the candidate, not so long ago.
All right, let's hear from Michelle Bachmann.
Mic check! Mic check! This will only take a minute.
This will only take a minute.
We have a message for Ms. Bachmann.
And this also recently happened to Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. A group of people in Wisconsin interrupted one of his speeches. Actually, it was in Chicago, I want to say. And they sort of had the same kind of moment, you know, criticizing the policies that have been in the news in Wisconsin lately. The other technique was something in Harlem. It's actually a woman who was living in a building that was kind of run down. It needed some upkeep that the landlord apparently wasn't doing. The city was knew about it but couldn't get in to fix it. So the woman went to Zuccotti Park. She said, "I see a lot of activists here who are trying to change things. Why don't you come to my building and help me out?" So they actually occupied the boiler room in her building until the landlord allowed the city in to fix the boiler, and that did happen. So we may see more of those quick, direct action kinds of activities.
What have we seen in the videos that have come out of these police breaking down the protest camps at Zuccotti Park and other locations?
We've seen kind of the same conversations that we've seen online typically, which those kind of videos tend to be very direct, and so they evoke a very visceral response from the people who watch them. So you'll see a lot of comments saying, "I can't believe that this is happening in America. I'm really disappointed," or "I'm really upset," and that sparks sort of a whole new round of sharing. Whether or not that leads to a greater awareness or greater participation in Occupy protests, I think we're just going to have to see.
Right, and I'm just hearing a lot of that sense of, you know, people being interviewed and saying, like, "I just want to go home and go to my bed and cook in my own kitchen."
Yeah, it's getting cold out there. I mean, you certainly can't blame anybody for wanting to go inside. And that's why I think we may see some more of these, like, mic checks and things like that, where same kinds of techniques, but in a different environment. It may or may not be, hard to say, but it may or may not be that we'll see things evolve.
Well, Brady, you have an adorable little son that I've seen some videos of, and I know that this is something that a lot of parents do. They make videos of their kids, and some of them are actually making money off of them. I'm thinking of when there's a little British kid whose little brother bites his finger, and apparently, you know, it's been seen 4 million times or something like that. You know, what's the incentive for somebody to make a viral video?
I think it's the chance to sort of have your 15 minutes, if I can use that almost outdated metaphor at this point. You know, we're now at the point where we're aware, at least most of us are aware, that what we're sharing is, you know, available to a greater amount of people than that we actually know personally. And so there's always that, you know, you're always thinking, "Oh, well, what is the thing that maybe will catch people's eye or, you know, will sort of, you know, make it out to the broader audience?" That said, I thought there was something interesting that happened on the Jimmy Kimmel show recently where he sort of put this idea to the test where he was talking about, he said, you know, parents, I want you to go home, make a video of your kids where you tell them you've eaten all of their Halloween candy and then film what happens and send it to us. And the kids freaked out because, I can't believe you took all my Halloween candy. And there was a little bit of discussion of whether that was, you know, a little too mean to the kids or whether it was all in good fun. But you know, I don't think there's any shortage, especially as the video gets better on smartphones and things like that. There's just the opportunity. You just think, well, my kid is the cutest kid in the world. Everybody's going to want to see this video.
Well, let's end that with something that's weird, even for the thing that you find online. A guy screaming at trucks.
I found this on BuzzFeed. I have no idea who it is or why it is, but he's found one of those DiGiorno pizza tractor trailers, and on the side of the truck it says, it's not delivery, it's DiGiorno. It's a delivery truck.
All right, let's hear it.
Hey! What are you doing? It's not delivery! It's DiGiorno!
Brady, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet, Virginia!
The side of the truck! Sheep! Hey! You're not yellow! You're orange! You're a liar!
This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Now we continue with the Out of the Shadow series on mental illness among youth. Today, WBEZ's Aurora Aguilar reports on a family being divided by mental illness in order to stay together.
The Smiths have an adopted son, Peter. He's 13 years old. As a toddler, he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Peter's often violent and aggressive, and his parents have done everything they can to get him the help he needs. Still, life has been hard for him, especially at school. This is his mother, Helen.
The school personnel would all be frowning at me, and it was clear that they wanted him gone. It's really hard when your child is not welcome. And people make it really clear that they don't want your kid around, that they would really prefer never to see your child again. When the other kids say, he's here.
People at school weren't the only ones feeling that way. Peter's 16-year-old sister Lisa is also adopted. When Lisa has a moment alone with her mom to talk about school or a fight with a friend, Peter bursts in.
Don't ruin my bowl. It's completely ruined. Stop it! Stop touching me!
Okay, you know the cut on your hand?
Stop!
Yeah, so you can, yes. you can just put some, like...
A loose string prevents Peter's bow from shooting arrows correctly. He bought this toy on a trip he took with his mom. The Smiths take separate vacations and don't celebrate birthdays together, mostly because of incidents like this one.
I'm not using my stupid bow after someone broke it.
Oh, honey, don't kick that, okay? Do you want to play the squeeze?
No, I don't want to.
I think it would be a really good idea.
Not in a good mood right now. No, not so more angry.
The family works around Peter's explosions. You won't hear from Peter's father. He doesn't want to reveal family details. But Helen says she does lots of things to keep the peace. For one, she still puts her 13-year-old son to bed.
Okay, now we have to find out where we left off, right? Getting tired? You ready to turn over? I could rub your back?
Yeah.
Okay. You feel better to scratch or to rub? Mm.
She scratches Peter's back until he falls asleep. Then she curls up next to him. When he's left alone, he screams until his mom or dad joins him. So for 5 years now, Helen has shared a twin bed with her son.
It avoids fighting and yelling and any kind of violence.
Sister Lisa has made her own adjustments. She's independent, funny, and animated, and attracts lots of friends. Those friends used to come over, but Peter has hit some of them, so now she keeps them away. She keeps her distance as well.
We can't be as close as, like, normal siblings. I don't feel like I can, really. Sometimes I'll just, like, build Legos with them, or I'll play, like, toys or whatever. Then I feel like it's hard, because he's so, like... moody. We could be getting along, and then, you know, I say something and he's like, why would you say that? And I'm like, okay, end of sibling bonding. I'm gonna go leave the room now.
Last year, Helen and her husband decided to send Peter away to a residential care center. This decision would change the dynamic of Lisa and Peter's relationship.
I'm out there.
that means that I'm not yelled means slowed down.
Helen and her husband visit Peter in Wisconsin. He's at a place that can deal with Peter's bipolar disorder.
Is it good to get out?
Yes, because I've always felt like a dungeon prison.
Why?
Because in prisons you have to stay in line for most all day.
At this point, Peter's been at the residential facility for 2 weeks. Visits like this are tough on everyone. On one trip, Peter and Lisa got into a fight in the backseat of the car. Dad got distracted and had to swerve to avoid hitting another car. Lisa told Peter she was only driving him to the residential center because she wanted to drop him off and be done with him.
Except it's not as loud when no.
While Peter's gone, Lisa revels in the peace at home. She's into this thing called emazing. It's sort of performance art that involves gloves with lighted fingertips. Her hands dance along to dubstep music. It's easier to practice now that Peter's gone.
Yeah, it's just been like really, 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 really calm. Usually we're walking on eggshells, trying to like not be loud and not, you know, play music he doesn't like. And now it's like I can come home and listen to whatever I want because it's not going to drive anyone crazy except for maybe my dad. But he's not going to go all Hulk on everybody and break stuff.
For a while, it's not clear whether things are working out for Peter. The family hears he's doing well, then not so well. Helen and her husband talk over options. Maybe Peter should stay at the residential facility for a year or two, or just come home. Lisa tells her mom that if Peter returns soon, she'll leave.
He's doing better there. He should stay there. We're all doing better that he's there. He should just stay there.
But you know it's only going to be still for a year, right?
Yeah.
What do you think about when he does come back for good?
Maybe by that time, he'll be like, I don't want to say like fixed or like 100% better, but he'll be doing a lot better.
After a few months, Helen and her husband make a decision. Peter will stay away from home in a new residential center just down the road. Helen thinks it's the best solution for Peter and for Lisa, at least for now.
If we bring him home, then we're all going to be in the same situation again. His behavior was really affecting her. Then we have to see her being hurt. So we hope that by getting him into residential care, that we'll be saving two kids. She needs help too. She needs respite from her brother's behavior.
Peter's time away from home stops the fighting, but it leaves big questions unanswered. Will Lisa accept Peter, and will they reconcile? Helen certainly hopes they will. She says it's important for the whole family to stick together. After all, Peter needs his parents now, but one day he might depend on his sister.
Our relationships with our siblings as children can carry over to a certain extent to adulthood, but, you know, many people say, hey, you know, I fought with my brother. We were like cats and dogs, and now we're really close. So, you know, a lot of what happens depends on how hard you work as an adult to create a bridge toward your sibling. I hope she'll do that. I hope they'll both do that.
Lisa's not sure what kind of relationship she wants with her brother.
I don't want to be, like, really distant and, like, talk to him, like, once a year. But then I think talking to him on the phone every day, it's just a little too much for me.
Lisa doesn't have much time to practice acting like an adult with her brother Peter. She's 16 now, and Peter could be at his residential facility for a year and a half. And by then, Lisa will be getting ready to go to college in New Mexico, far from Peter. Aurora Aguilar, WBEZ.
Welcome back. New Hampshire's immigrant story is a rich and varied one, containing narratives of integration, epics of disunion, and chapters of unexpected harmony. Bethany Covenant Church in Bedford serves communities surrounding Manchester, a city that is also a destination for refugee resettlement. Some Sudanese exiles sought out Bethany Covenant upon arriving in the U.S. Joel Krugel is pastor, and he told us about the unique relationship between his church and the Sudanese, and a new project aiming to bridge not only the cultural, but digital divide.
We
have interesting connections. Our denomination, the Evangelical Covenant Church, we worked in the refugee camps in Ethiopia and Kenya where the Sudanese were. Most of the Sudanese that have settled in Manchester, they sought asylum in Egypt from the Sudan, and then they were resettled here by the U.S. government as political refugees. I think the first came in about the year 2000, and I think the last arrived maybe in 2006. So when the Sudanese came to Manchester 10 years ago, a number of them worshipped here, but it became kind of apparent that they had a different culture, language, mm-hmm. music. So a couple of years ago, we said, hey, what if we help sponsor your forming a new church that would be true to your language and culture and customs? They were very excited about it, so we, along with our denomination, have been the financial sponsors to get the new church going.
So do you consider this part of your mission, I mean, to help educate people for general purposes in the ways of the world, or is there a special purpose for your ministry in this project?
Well, it does reflect our mission, and in fact, we put together a mission statement or a vision statement, and one of our visions was a couple of years ago that we could assist in the planting of a new church in the Manchester area. We didn't know at the time that it was a Sudanese church, but the need became apparent. We had a relationship with the Sudanese, and so it became a natural extension of Bethany. The roots of our church, in fact, are with the Swedish immigrants to Manchester in the late 1800s. So we thought, hey, who are the new immigrants that we could touch with God's love and with practical expressions of care?
So tell us about this project to get computers and training to some of these refugees.
Yeah, it's an exciting project. Sometimes it's easier for us to write a check than to offer our time and our expertise. However, we've been challenging our congregation to say, hey, how can we get next to these new friends? What do they need that we might be able to provide? One of the things that we soon discovered was that the computer literacy rate among the adults in the Sudanese population was quite low. So we made it known at our church here at Bethany. I said, hey, if anyone would like to teach computer to our Sudanese friends. We also have a need for some actual laptops. And the good news was Rick Dumais, a high-tech guy here in the area, said, hey, I would love to do that. So Rick has been teaching with the Sudanese, and I think to date we've had 12 or 14 computers from our congregation donated to these Sudanese families that are taking the training.
And I understand that you're working with a company called C-Tech to actually revitalize these machines and turn them over. Is that correct?
We are beginning that relationship. To date, the machines that we've offered to them have all been donated by people in our congregation. And another interesting thing is a young 14-year-old junior high school kid, Brian, has real talent in refurbishing computers. So these kids know so much today in terms of technology. So Brian has been revitalizing the machines that have been donated to the Sudanese. And then Rick teaches the classes. And for every family that commits to the classes, we offer them a computer.
Well, Pastor Krugel, it's an inspiring story. And, you know, as you mentioned, the history of immigration in Manchester is a very rich one. But as you know, now there is some pressure to put a moratorium on immigration and refugees with the claim that it's stretching resources just a little too thin. How about you? What do you think if we stop letting immigrants into communities like Manchester?
Well, there's so many different facets to immigration. There's so many people who are waiting in line to come to our country. There are many like the Sudanese who were in a very difficult political situation in their own country, actually were forced out of their country, and of course a lot of persecution. So you know, our heart would be for especially populations that are suffering political persecution that if all possible, as an expression of American care and compassion, that we could open our doors to them, as we have the resources to do so. And these people are so appreciative. I have to tell you, just any help that comes to them, there's a deep sense of gratefulness that being here is a real gift.
Well, it's a terrific project, and best of luck with it. Any way that the public can help?
We could still use a few more computers. Actually, it's amazing. I believe we have 28 families represented right now in the computer training modules that we're doing. I think we probably have need for another half dozen or dozen good laptop or desktop computers. So if anyone out there would like to make a gift, they could be in touch with the church, and we'll make sure it gets into the hands of a deserving family.
And we'll make sure we have a link for more information on that. Good. At our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, thank you so much, and again, best of luck.
Thank you so much.
Pastor Joel Krugel there of Bethany Covenant Church in Bedford. In the background, congregants from the Sudanese Evangelical Covenant Church celebrating the independence of South Sudan at Veterans Park in Manchester last month. You can find a link to contact Bethany Covenant for more on donating your old computer, as well as to a nonprofit called SeaTac, which refurbishes old computers for immigrant and low-income people in the Manchester area. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Now onto something way beyond home computing technology, cybernetic implants, once the stuff of science fiction. Some prosthetics are now advanced robotic machines capable of picking up electronic signals directly from the brain using sensors placed on the skin. So why have you not seen this kind of technology in your neighborhood? Well, the advanced implants can cost upwards of $14,000, adding a whole new meaning to it'll cost you an arm and a leg.
It was the first time that a person I was interviewing, in this case a doctor, showed up with somebody's hand in a paper bag.
Ta-da! I've been carrying around these hands for a number of days now. Yeah.
The prosthetic hand had been sent in for a periodic servicing, and now reconstructive surgeon Professor Oscar Asman returns it to the rightful owner, 23-year-old Patrick Meyerhofer. Meyerhofer's expression is that of a kid wrestling open a candy box as he eases the stump of his elbow into the prosthetic casing. It looks like a gentler version of the Terminator hand, with metal joints and skinny fingers of white plastic.
Put on the power.
It's always a miracle to me, you know.
The story began 3 years ago with an accident. Meyerhofer, a technician in Linz, Austria, was electrocuted by a current of 6,000 volts. He was airlifted to the General Hospital of Vienna, where Asman managed to save his severely damaged left arm. But Meyerhofer was left with a hand that no longer worked, and began a long cycle of reconstructive surgeries under Asman, along with full-time physiotherapy.
1.5 years later, my hand still has no function and no feeling. And then he told me, okay, Patrick, we have done all what's possible with the medicine, and your hand still does not work anymore.
And how many operations had you gone through with him?
9 operations.
Asman says he understood why Meyerhofer was looking for alternatives to surgery.
Most of these patients that have injuries of that sort are young patients, and so nobody likes to spend time in the hospital except doctors. You know? You have to imagine every hand surgical reconstruction has an immense phase of rehabilitation that comes after that.
So surgeon and patient went down the street, from the General Hospital to the offices of Otto Bock Healthcare, a medical technology firm that lays claim to the first mind-controlled bionic arm in Europe. Here's Janos Kalma from the R&D department, demonstrating how the latest version of the prosthetic hand, called Michelangelo, reads signals directly from the brain.
The hand is connected to the body through the socket, like this, for example, and these electrodes sits in this socket and contact directly the skin.
This part is important. The electrodes pick up electric signal directly from the skin. It works like this. Normally, when we want to move our hand, our brain sends a tiny jolt to nerves in the forearm. Now, even if the hand no longer exists, we can still tell our brain to move it, and the brain dutifully sends out that same jolt.
And with such electrodes, we can pick up these muscle activations, these small voltages on the skin, and with two of them, we can control the hand, open and close the hand.
After such demos, Meyerhofer agreed to become one of the first few people to test this bionic hand, which won't be released until later this year. But first, he had to convince his family that amputating his existing hand was not such a crazy idea.
They said, oh my God, what are you doing? But with the company of the book, I make videos and show it to my family and so on, and they said, wow, that's amazing what you can do. You go to Vienna and 3 hours later you can grab your glass, and so you can't do with your hand for 3 years.
The amputation was the simple part, says Asman, done in about 20 minutes. But more important was the creation of a new neurological network that would generate a signal strong enough to power the prosthetic. This is what he calls bionic reconstruction. Meyerhofer's surgery was 9 months ago. Now, after much hard practice, when he thinks of moving his hand in certain ways, his bionic hand obeys. Today, these are the things he says he's most proud of: riding his bike to work, climbing with friends, eating with a fork and a knife. He is the first person to go through such a procedure in Europe, according to Osman, but probably not the last.
I see probably now one new patient a week that has had an injury in the past. And right now, he will not be a good candidate for a bionic reconstruction, but I will make him a good candidate. Meaning we can reroute the nerves, we can get new muscle attached, we can alter the skeletal environment so that the patient in the end will have excellent conditions for a prosthetic device.
The Austrian government has given 3 million euros to the hospital to create a new center of bionic reconstruction. Osman says it will open in September of this year. Shruti Pinnamaneni, Deutsche Welle Radio, Vienna.
Well, that's it for today. You can listen to and pass along segments from today and every day by going to wordofmouthradio.org. Please join us tomorrow at noon and again at 9 p.m. for more Word of Mouth from NHPR.